secretly filming them, and we reflect on why. In 1963, the Israeli government pulled the plug on their own Mossad operation to bring Joseph Mengele, Martin Bormann, Klaus Barbie and other war criminals to justice. Plus, Martin Summers will have his usual roundup of world events. I'm afraid it doesn't look like we can bring you the news right now, but we will have a bit of music instead.
Sister Josephine, what do all these policemen mean by coming to the convent in a grim limousine after Sister Josephine? While you, Sister Josephine, you sit with your boots up on the altar screen, you smoke one last cigar. What a funny nun you are. The policemen say that Josephine's a burglar in disguise, big bad Norman, 15 years on the run. The sisters disbelieve it, no, that can't be Josephine. Just think about her tenderness towards the younger nuns. Oh, Sister Josephine, they're searching the chapel where you've been seen, the nooks and the crannies of the nuns' canteen, after Sister Josephine. While you, Sister Josephine, you sip one farewell Benedictine before your au revoir. A right funny nun you are. Admittedly, her hands are big and hairy and embellished with a curious tattoo. Admittedly, her voice is on the deep side and she seems to shave more often than the other sisters do. Oh, Sister Josephine, founder of the convent pontoon team, they're looking through your bundles of rare magazines after Sister Josephine. While you, Sister Josephine, you give a goodbye sniff of Benzedrine to the convent budgerigar. A bloody funny nun you are. No longer will her snores ring through the chapel during prayers, nor her lustful moanings fill the stilly night. No more empty bottles of altar wine come clunking from her cell. No longer will the cloister toilet seat stand upright. Oh, Sister Josephine, slipping through their fingers like Vaseline, leaving them to clutch your empty crinoline after Sister Josephine. While you, Sister Josephine, sprinting through the suburbs when last seen, dressed only in your wimple and your rosary, a right funny nun you seem to be.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show, Friday Drive Time, with old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. The privatisation of the London Olympic security has left the entire event wide open to terrorist attacks. The privatisation of the London Olympic security has left it open to terrorist attacks. So, it's a problem so huge, and a contract, all £280 million of it, so huge that nobody knows what to do about it. And the London Olympics begins in just 4 weeks today. So the answer has been to pretend there's no problem and hope for the best. We talked to Lee Hazeldine, who's been undercover at the Olympics security firm G4S. Plus, We go back to the 1970s to pick up an incredible story of former Nazis living happily in South America and even putting out disinformation through the world press to cover their crimes. A documentary team led by World in Action's John Ware, who then went on to run Panorama, was secretly filming them. So we reflect on why, in 1963, the Israeli government pulled the plug on their own Mossad operation to bring Joseph Mengele, Martin Bormann, Klaus Barbie and other war criminals to justice. So we are joined on the line now by Lee Hazeldine.
Hi Lee, and welcome to Drive Time.
Hi, it's a pleasure, thanks for having me.
Now Lee, you've been working undercover, that is basically getting trained up by private security firm G4S, the old Group 4 Security, ready for the London Olympics. First of all, how did you get the job? Was it easy?
Yeah, it was very easy. I basically went down to a training centre which is located in Stratford in East London. Signed up there, said yep, and basically took some details, and that was it. I was signed up for the London Olympics, basically. They sent me out an application form some time later. I filled it out. I put work references down and personal references. I also had to fill it out online as well, and that's all that I did.
So have you been vetted?
No, I haven't, surprisingly enough. My work references and personal references have not been checked. You know, I'm a journalist, so all they'd have to do is check one of my work references. I mean, I don't try and hide the fact that I'm a journalist. I mean, that would be, you know. So we put the work references down, and it's a news agency. One of my work references are, and that obviously should have flagged something with them, but it hasn't been checked. So I'm still in as of today.
Okay, now, I mean, the idea of private security running this thing, I mean, you know, could you just give us an idea of your first experiences for working for G4S and being, I suppose, in some way trained to do the job?
Yeah, well, they're quite fanatical, I have to say that, in their views, and quite predatory. As far as everyone's concerned, is that members of the public are basically scum of the earth as far as they're concerned. The police have no power over them, and we get told this on a regular basis. Don't worry about the police, they can't do anything. As for training, it's been a joke, quite honestly. We've had 3 days of PowerPoint presentations, and one day working with the pedestrian screening area, which is where everyone will go through as they queue up for the Olympics with their tickets. They'll then go through an airport-style pedestrian screening area, and where someone like me will basically check that they're not having any metal items, the x-ray machine operators, and in theory that would work perfectly, except that people are not being trained properly to use the equipment. The x-ray operators, and I know because I'm one of them, only had 2 days worth of training and then expected to basically find everything, and obviously, you know, IEDs and things like that, you know, don't come, you know, looking like an IED. They're component parts. So, you know, 2 days worth of training and, you know, you're expected to do all this sort of stuff. Plus the metal detectors are only going to work one in every 50 times. So for every 50 people to go through, they'll ping once. And at peak times, we were told just the other day that they will be turned off completely. So therefore, if you're a terrorist, all you need to do is queue up, go through the lines of people, and the chances are that as long as you've got whatever it is on you, like ammunition or something, they can, you'll walk straight through the metal detector. In fact, I was asked to be a would-be terrorist on the final training day, and I was given a knife, a gun, an IED, and on all three occasions throughout the day, I got through the metal detector, and I also got through the x-ray machine scanners. And when I actually went through the metal detector, first it didn't go off, and then they decided to use the hand wand. I noticed the chap who was using the hand wand hadn't actually turned it on, which I then informed him. He turned it on, and then when it pinged at the right place, he failed to spot the knife that I had on me. I also walked through with ammunition on, you know, and you know, if someone walks through with one round of ammunition, if 50 other people do that, which terrorists do this, then guess what? You've got 50 rounds of ammunition in the Olympics, and that's a massacre.
Well, can you tell me a little bit about yourself? Because it's not everybody that does this sort of undercover investigative work. Whereabouts have you cut your teeth, Lee?
I worked for a television programme, which was an undercover television programme. I don't want to say too much about that, because obviously that will give me away, because I won't be too hard to find. But that's basically where I worked. And then after that, I've worked freelance, and I've worked with a number of agencies as well, doing various undercover assignments. I've done stories on the IRA. We infiltrated what would be an IRA handler and his team, and I did a big story for that, which was a real eye-opener about false flag information, about the British government actually putting in soldiers into the IRA to then set off bombs and train the other members of the IRA and all that kind of stuff. So we've done a lot of stories like that. We also did Cast for Questions back in the day on the Conservative Party and all that kind of stuff. So, yeah, so I've done quite a bit of work like this. And the thing is, it never surprises me that... every time I go into a situation, it's the level of corruption and the just the blatantness of it all. G4S are basically looking at numbers, getting lots of people through. They are not training them properly, and this is a major event for the world. It's going to be an amazing event, hopefully. And, you know, quite honestly, it's open to a terrorist attack very easily. And I don't say that lightly.
Yeah, but I mean, surely the obvious thing to do, Lee, is to go to somebody like Andy Davis, the Home Affairs editor at Channel 4 News.
Yeah, he said he wasn't interested. I actually went to him. Yeah. I sent him an email and I called. He was not interested. And he said that there is a media blackout on this kind of story, that nobody would be interested in running it. And so far, you're the only guys who are interested in hearing about this at all, you know. I thought people would jump on the bandwagon and would say, yeah, we really want to know what's going on. But apparently not. They don't want to know. It's as simple as that.
Yeah, but it's pretty worrying if the... Do you also worry a little bit yourself that maybe by putting this information out there, explaining that there's very little proper security going to be happening at the London Olympics, that actually may encourage some sort of terror attack?
No, not really. Because the thing is, if we thought like that, we'd never do anything, would we? The thing is, when you work on a story such as this, it's your duty as somebody who is a British citizen, who cares about their country, who cares about what's going on and what's happening right now in their country, and if there is going to be a terrorist attack, at least I can say, well, look, hold on a second, these are where the problem areas are going to be, and hopefully there is 4 weeks to go, G4S can get their act together and start tightening up security, perhaps actually training people, which would be really handy. I mean, I was given a booklet, and one of the things in the booklet from G4S is about a key training sample, and it's what does a security guard do the night before his shift? Have something to eat, get some sleep, iron his uniform. And that's the extent of the training that people are being given, you know.
Okay. Now, what about the security being inadequately run by a training company called Contemporary International? Who are these people, and how are they involved with G4S?
Well, we're not quite sure. Contemporary International seems to be an events management company. I have heard from various people within G4S that it's a G4S subsidiary company. But at the moment, I haven't actually got any proof of that. They seem to be a separate company. I'm not quite sure. However, I think what's happened is that G4S has subcontracted the training to Contemporary International. And Contemporary International claim to do all sorts of events. However, when you go onto their website, you can't actually look at anything without a password. So they're very secretive and very private about what they do, which is a very worrying thing. Their trainers are all... military personnel, and that was quite worrying to me first when I first arrived. You get a lot of shouting at, you get a lot of kind of you're in the army now kind of mentality, and the trainers are basically there to go through these PowerPoint presentations very quickly, very briefly. They're not really trying to make anyone understand anything, so that's basically what they do. And to understand G4S is that you've got to understand that they are a military organization. They look like a civilian company on the outside, but internally they are run by, everyone's a major, everyone's, you know, people are colonels I've met there. I mean, there's all sorts of guys. I met a major who's a doctor who works for G4S, who's also in Woolwich Barracks, checking people there as well, because there's 100,000 people going through Woolwich Barracks apparently since I think January of this year, which is a huge amount of troops coming through. And he says not all of those troops are British troops, and there's a lot of UN troops coming into London and being posted in and around London, and they're all having to go through Woolwich Barracks to begin with. So G4S and, you know, these event management companies are run with military personnel, and that's who you're dealing with, basically.
Okay, well, what about, I mean, this sounds pretty amazing that we've got, you know, what you're saying is alleging there that there are actually foreign troops coming in to Woolwich. I mean, that's pretty incredible. Any idea what nationalities and how many foreign troops, as well as British troops? I mean, certainly from friends that I know who have got brothers and sisters in the military, this kind of thing, are saying that pretty much everybody in the British military, many people, including, you know, RAF, people in the RAF who would normally be doing sort of desk job, say, up north somewhere, are also being drafted down to London. But you're saying, on top of that, there are foreign troops too coming through Woolwich Barracks.
Yeah, he didn't really go into too much detail, other than say there's definitely American troops that he'd seen already, and definitely German troops that he'd seen already. The official line is, what we were told on our first day of training, was that there would be 3,000 uniformed soldiers, which would be helping the public, giving directions, all that sort of stuff, as well as kind of other security roles. Obviously, they would have the undercover guys there too and all that kind of stuff. But there was been no mention of this 100,000 troops. And so when I brought that up, I was told, don't talk about it. That's none of your business. How did you know? And I said, well, I know somebody who mentioned it, so I thought I'd mention it to you guys, you know. And they're like, don't talk about this. This is not for you to know, you know. And actually, that's been a lot of the time that I've asked questions whilst we're doing the training. I've said, look, why are the metal detectors going to be switched off, you know, at peak times? And they said simply, don't ask. And then when I push, they say, well, look, it's to get the people through, you know, because they're so worried. There's going to be 80,000 people in the stadium. That's 80,000 members of the public. Then you're going to have all the security staff and all the back of house staff. And then you're going to have more people in the actual park itself. And they've got to come through a pedestrian screening area as well. So to get into the park, you're going to have to come through a pedestrian screening area. One assumes, again, by G4S, I don't know for a fact, but those machines will probably be turned off to get the people in. And then to get the people in again to the stadiums, they'll be turning off those machines as well. And it's an absolute travesty. But you're just told not to say anything. Especially, don't speak to any journalists, which obviously makes me laugh.
Okay. Yeah, Lee, I mean, surely, to a certain extent, that's normal in any sort of high-security event, that people are going to only be told things on a need-to-know basis in order to make sure that, say, for example, a terrorist can't find out what the security arrangements are.
Yeah, absolutely. And that is completely normal. But the thing is about this is that it feels wrong. You know, I've been involved in a lot of security things over my career. I know a lot of high-ranking police officers, a lot of high-ranking military guys and stuff. I've spoken to a lot of people, and as I'm going through this training process, I'm saying this to me doesn't feel right. We're not being trained properly. The metal detectors, you know, they don't work properly. If you've got something in your hand and you walk through a metal detector, it should go off. Well, these ones don't, because they're not the expensive ones that you would find in an airport. These are the cheaper ones that this company Rapiscan has supplied to the Olympics. And I think, you know, half of me says maybe this is suspicious, and you know, I'm actually quite worried. But the other half of me just says, well, maybe this has just gone to people who've bid the lowest for the contracts, and, you know, are fulfilling it with the cheapest equipment, the cheapest labor. I mean, they're dragging, you know, with all due respect to all the G4S staff who they're hiring, they're dragging the sort of the depths of the job centres. I mean, I've been in classes where drug deals have been going down in the open.
Sorry, right? You're saying that some of the people who are training for Olympic security are doing drug deals while they're being trained?
In my classroom, whilst I am being trained, yeah, I have been offered hash, I've been offered pills, right? And when I've just said no, that it's gone to someone else, a trainer, one of the military trainers who's in the room, saw someone doing it, tapped him on the shoulder and said, can you do it outside in a break, right? That's ridiculous. That shouldn't happen.
Something else that I know you've seen is some of the people who are doing the training actually taking photographs on their mobile phones of some of the secure areas.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, we know for a fact terrorists take surveillance photos. They did it in 9/11, they had the rehearsals, they've done it in 7/7, they had rehearsals for that. People in my class that I've seen have been taking photos. Now, we're told that there's mobile phone jammers in every room, in every corridor, and that your mobile phone won't work. You may be able to take one or two photographs, but after, you know, a week or so, your phone will die a death, apparently, right? And so, you know, I questioned again one of the trainers about this, and he said, he told me, no, there's no jammers, it's a verbal deterrent, right? And so what happens is because it's a verbal deterrent and there's actually no jammers in any of the classrooms, people are taking pictures on their mobile phones. Now, a few of them have been seen. And what happens is that people get tapped on the shoulder, they say, can you erase the photograph? They say yes, and they continue on with the training. Surely, those people should be taken out of the training, handed over to the police, and at least questioned and asked, why were you taking photographs of the training, of the trainers, and of the pedestrian screening areas? And these are the, you know, in the training facility, it's an actual mock-up of what it would be like at the Olympics. So as they're taking pictures, they're filming and photographing actually what it's going to be like, the arrangements are actually going to be in place. This company, Creative International, is causing a terrorist breach by letting these people continue with the training, surely.
Now, another thing that you've pointed out is that sometimes people who haven't even completed their SIA licences, and maybe you want to tell us what they are actually being put in charge of people who are actually highly trained security officers, for example, ex-soldiers and ex-police.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. The SIA licence, it was issued to the security industry some years ago, just because people, you know, the door supervisors in nightclubs and stuff were, you know, beating people up and attacking people and what have you, and there's all sorts of trouble. So what they decided to do, the government said, look, let's regulate the industry and we'll create the SIA, which is the Security Industry Authority license. And so everybody who works in security has to have an SIA license, no matter who you are, whether you're from a security guard on a gate, a door supervisor on a nightclub, or whether you're a close protection officer working in Afghanistan for G4S, right? Everyone has to have a license. And you see them, they stand out in nightclubs, they've usually got the armband on with the blue license in the pouch or around their neck in some way. So G4S have had funding from the government and from sponsors to put people through their SIA licenses, because it's actually quite expensive to actually go out and get it. I think it's about £370 to £400, depending on where you go. So for the person who is sort of, say, on the dole, who hasn't worked, you know, in a long time, long-term unemployed, you know, still needs to get £300 or £400 and go to do their SIA licenses, you know, it's not doable. So they've been given funding in order to get the long-term unemployed back into work, which is a great idea. However, what they're doing is they're taking the four-day course and they're basically just rushing people through it, because they've got so many thousands of people to get through these courses. They're rushing people through it. They're not completing their courses properly, and so forth. They're not going to be trained properly in the basics of security guarding, you know, let alone, you know, anything else. When I did SIA license myself, I had a wonderful trainer who had worked in clubs, who was an ex-soldier, could tell you all sorts of stories and what have you, and he made sure that everybody passed the exams properly. Well, in G4S and their trainers, they're not doing that. And so what people are doing is they're getting sent letters, and on these letters they've got, you are going to work in a pedestrian screening area. That's the letter I got. Someone else has got a letter saying, you are going to be a team leader. Now, a team leader is the person who's in charge of a pedestrian screening area. That is the person that, if you've got a problem, say someone walks through a metal detector and it goes off and you can't find the object on the person, you put your hand up and it's team leader. That team leader is supposed to be an experienced person, someone who is calm and professional, who knows exactly what they're doing. And people who haven't even passed their SIA licenses yet are getting flagged up to be team leaders. Now, I had a Gurkha come to me, a Gurkha, right, who says, how come I'm not a team leader? This is ridiculous. I've had ex-policemen say, well, look, you know, I've been with the Met Police X amount of years. I retired. I wanted to do something. I had an SIA license, so I've come to do the Olympics. And I'm not a team leader. I've got 20 years in the police. I mean, you know, this is crazy. So, again, it's, to me, my suspicious mind says something's wrong with this. And, you know, and it's definitely not right that people are being looked over with experience against people who've not even done their SIA licenses. And I don't understand that. And then it comes back down to maybe it's just a money thing. Maybe it's just cheaper just to get these people through, you know, as quickly as possible. They don't care who's going to be a team leader or not. You know, they get in the minimal training. If anything really serious happens, I suppose the police are there. There are other people there. They can just flag it up. But still, these are people that are going to be representing the country, the people of this great country, to people from all over the world. And these people are the first people you're going to meet. And, you know, with again, greatest respect to everybody, they don't speak English very well. The majority of them don't, you know. Some don't speak English at all. We had, on the fourth day, we had a brief test where we had to basically talk someone through a bag search. One person who was standing next to me couldn't speak a word of English, and the trainer said, "It's okay, I know what you mean." And I turned to him and said, "Well, can you explain? I don't know what he means." And I laughed, and the trainer just said, "Don't worry about it, mate." You know? And so these people are going to be representing this great country to all these people from around the world. When you queue up with your tickets, these are the first people that you're going to meet. Basically, thugs. You know, and, you know, with the greatest respect to a lot of the people there, you know, a lot of them actually do want to do a good job, but are complaining constantly because they don't know what they're doing. And they know they don't know what they're doing. And they know they're going to be on show. And they know that this is going to be a big event. And they're worried that they're going to let, say, the side down. And everyone's talking amongst themselves, which is how I get most of my great information from.
Well, I imagine that hopefully, anyway, G4S will take some of what you're saying on board. Do you think there's any possibility of that, or will they just be totally in denial about it?
No, I shouldn't think they will at all. I mean, I really hope they do. I think it's really important. I mean, I'm going to be trying to get the story out before the Olympics anyway, as best as I can, because I think it's really important to tighten everything up to make sure that those metal detectors are working all the time. You know, a friend of mine in an airport said, you know, the metal detectors ping once every 10 people, you know, and that's called a random search. That's fair enough. Why can't we just have that? They have just as many people coming through, you know, okay, maybe not in the peak times, but look, the metal detectors have got to work, and that's my main worry. I'm not trying to out G4S as a bad company or anything like that. I mean, they are a huge company. There's nearly a million people that work for them, and I think that's sinister within itself, actually, that, you know, a company with nearly a million people working for them, you know, is putting so many people into London at the time of the Olympics, and especially as also we're being told about this, let me try and get my quote absolutely correct, this defining moment in the history of London. And the trainer who told me this from Contemporary International wasn't referring to the Olympics. She said, after the Olympics, there is going to be a defining moment in the history of London. And I said, well, what do you mean by that? And she said, we can't say, it's just that's what's going to happen. And so I'm getting worried now and thinking, well, look, there's all these foreign troops coming in. There's thousands of G4S people in the country. What's going to happen? Maybe nothing. Maybe it's just a precaution. Or maybe they're just saying you're going to be employed by G4S afterwards. You know, there are lots of questions still to be asked. And I think G4S needs to actually come out and they need to tell the truth. Is it just shoddy, you know, they're just, you know, bid the lowest for the contracts and they've got these contracts to fulfill and they can't fulfill them in the price that they've said, so they're cutting corners left, right and centre. If it's that, to be fair, that's okay, that can be fixed. We can deal with that. We can start doing the searches of the stadium again. We can tighten up the security, the pedestrian screening areas. Because, you know, if one person gets through into that Olympic stadium, just one, even if it's with a handgun, with one bullet in, that's going to be the Olympic message, you know? And to me, that's disgraceful. So, look, you know...
Well, no, hang on a second, though, Lee, because this defining moment you're talking about there, I mean, surely she could have been talking about something positive, you know, actually the Olympics being a positive defining moment for Britain.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely, she could have been. I'm quite a paranoid person, and so I found it quite sinister.
Well, I mean, you're not the only one who you would actually, you know, say use the word paranoid flippantly there, but just to remind people that that there's a whistleblower working for G4S on the Olympics was sacked after speaking out about G4S cutting corners when vetting security staff for the Olympics. This was reported by the Daily Mail on the 2nd of June. That's just a couple of weeks ago. Sarah Hubble was told not to return after contacting the media about her experiences working for G4S. Well, obviously, Lee, she wasn't as smart as you. She wasn't in there undercover. She said she had access to passport information, bank account details and national insurance cards, but had not herself been vetted. She said staff had to process a minimum of 10 applications an hour, and the documents ended piled up in corners of their office in Stockton-on-Tees. She claimed the system was creaking under the pressure of processing thousands of applications ahead of this summer's games. When asked about it by the Daily Mail, G4S simply said that she was lying.
Yeah, that sounds about right. And look, you know, how many people can be lying, quite honestly? You know, she cared about the Olympics. We all care about the Olympics. What we want to see is an amazing event where this country can do itself proud, can take part in all the games, can say, hey, look, we put on an amazing event that is up there with some of the best Olympics that has ever been. That's all that we want to have happen. And companies like G4S are doing their damnedest to basically, you know, make sure that doesn't happen by not doing things properly. You know, obviously, you know, I want to try and stay in there for as long as possible without getting found out by G4S, so I'm sure there's going to be a big manhunt in the next time I go into work, you know, if they're listening to this. And try and really stay there for as long as possible to see what the outcomes of all this is, because if I was to leave now, obviously I'd only have half the picture. So I actually want to stay in there for as long as possible, hopefully to the Olympics, and then keep reporting back on what's going on and how they're doing.
Well, nice one, Lee, and I hope you can maybe report back to this show over the weeks as long as you get on. Now, also, another thing you said that which is also really worrying is that uniforms are going missing or being stolen from the uniform distribution centre in the training facilities.
Yes, absolutely. Okay. This came directly from a contemporary international person, and I reconfirmed it with a G4S security guard. Somebody had come into the training area and they were given a uniform by mistake, and they were told to then go back out to hand it back in. And then someone else came out and said, you know, uniforms are going missing all the time. If you've got a letter to pick up a uniform, you're the only people that's supposed to pick up a uniform, right? Okay, but people aren't. People are going up to the uniform depot, as it were, and saying, I'm here for a uniform. Oh, I forgot my email. And again, don't worry about it, we'll give you a uniform. Now, again, we know in Iraq, in Afghanistan, terrorists get police and security uniforms. They dress up, they have the accreditation, they then come back in, and then they do something. This is, you know, modus operandi, you know, of a terrorist. So that to me is extremely worrying as well. And on top of the uniforms as well, people have been given the wrong accreditation material, and the accreditation material comes from LOCOG. And what LOCOG do is that they look at everybody and they say, okay, you're going to be a security guard for G4S. These are the areas that you're allowed to go into. You know, you're going to be assigned to the stadium, or you're going to be assigned just the outer perimeter. And in the outer perimeter, that gives you access to the Olympic Park. Or if you're in the stadium, that's going to give you access to, you know, all the administration buildings, the Olympic Park and the other Olympic venues only, right? People have been saying that they've been given the wrong accreditation. I had an army guy come to me, and he said, look, you know, I've just basically been given the wrong accreditation. And I was told to go away and come back in a week. To get it replaced in a week. I mean, you know, this is crazy. What happens if that guy didn't come back? You know, he wasn't, you know, you can see he was an honest guy and he was worried. And so, you know, what happens if that, you know, a terrorist actually goes there, says, look, you know, I want accreditation. I'm on the training course. Here's my, you know, proof I'm on the training course. They give him accreditation. It's the wrong accreditation, and he just never comes back except for when the games start and he will be able to walk into the Olympic Park. This is how worrying it all is. You know, uniforms going missing. wrong accreditation being given to people. I mean, this is not just G4S, this is Contemporary International, and this is LOCOG as well. And let's just say that LOCOG is a private company, and basically they're not accountable to anybody, as they keep telling us, you know?
Okay, we're getting towards the end of your, because you sent me a sort of bullet point list of various things that you discovered, and one of the most worrying ones is that there is also a plan for the evacuation of the whole of London as part of the Olympic plans, and G4S are involved in, just in case something goes wrong. The whole of London? Can you really evacuate the whole of London?
Well, that's what I said, but apparently you can. And as far as I know, what's basically, what's going to happen is that the security guards used for the Olympics will be at the forefront of getting the public out of London. And I don't know how they're going to do that, because we haven't been told that much. But that's all that basically they've said to us, is that if there's need for an evacuation of London, and they seem quite serious about it, this didn't seem something like, you know, they spent a lot of time on this. You know, for example, on day two, they were talking about, you know, the pedestrian screening areas, and they covered that in like half an hour. They spent a good 2 hours talking about the evacuation of London and how important.
Now, just a minute, Lee, hang on a minute. There's something like 11.5 million people in London. How the hell are they going to get 11.5 million people out?
Well, I don't know. But the thing is, if you think about it, if you've got, you know, you've got 125,000 people that are basically working for the Olympics at the Olympic site. That's including security, various contractors, and other people with accreditation, police, security, everything. Then you've got the army that's going to be there, and plus this other batch of army that are coming in. Now, if it's true that there really are 100,000 other troops coming into London and being held at barracks all around London, surely, you know, maybe that would be enough to get people out of London. If, I suppose, that there was a terrorist attack that was so horrific, everyone would want to go anyway. You know, and that's what I've been thinking about. That's the only way, I guess, you know, people would want to leave London, is if a biological chemical weapon had gone off. You'd want to get as far away from London as possible, and so therefore you need as much help as possible. The fact that they're saying it before the Olympics is quite worrying to me.
Well, surely, they're saying that they're being well prepared, surely.
Yeah, maybe so. Yeah, absolutely. And that's what you've got to think. Otherwise, you wouldn't turn up for work, would you? You know. But, you know, it's worrying, you know. I've never heard that said before. But then again, we've never had an Olympics here before. Well, not in my lifetime anyway. So, you know, I'm just being, you know, again, paranoid about everything a little bit. But then, you know, that's what's kept me alive all these years.
Okay, the final thing is the casket linings. This is basically for dead bodies. Apparently 200,000 of those being shipped into London.
Yeah, these casket linings can hold... I didn't know what they were at first, because they said casket linings, and I said, what's that? I said, is that for a coffin? And they said, no, it's kind of is a coffin. And I said, oh, okay. And they said, well, they can hold 4 to 5 bodies each casket lining can. And I suppose, you know, again, if a terrorist attack or something was to happen at the Olympics, you'd probably need, you know, a lot of these things, to put people in, you know. So again, to me, again, that was quite worrying, you know. From the day one of joining the Olympics, I felt it's got more sinister as time has gone on. And, you know, obviously you're getting little tidbits of information. They're not telling you everything. Obviously they can't, because that's a security risk in itself. But if they just said, hey, look, this is a precaution, this isn't going to happen, but if it did, this is the procedures that we do. Well, they're not saying it like that. They're saying, these are the casket linings, and this is what, you know, we're going to be putting people in if something happens, you know. And to me, I don't think I need to know that as a security guard working for G4S on a pedestrian screening area. Maybe I do if I'm a policeman, maybe I do if I'm a part of the other emergency services, but as a security guard, I don't think we need to know all this particular information, you know, especially about the evacuation of London and things like that. And it seemed to me that they were reveling in giving us this information. They were giving us kind of, you know, one of the guys, Nicholas, who is one of the trainers at Contemporary International, was laughing about it as he was giving this information, and almost sort of, you know, he was excited by it. And to me, that was worrying. If that was me giving the information, I'd be very deliberate, I'd be very sober, and I'd say, hey, look, you know, this is a precaution, but... dot, 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 dot. And it's not being delivered that way. And on the other hand, you can think, well, maybe, you know, these guys at G4S and Contemporary International, you know, they are ex-soldiers. They don't think anything of saying things, and they're just saying things as they would do if they were still in the army. And I understand that to a certain degree as well.
Okay, well, Lee Hazeldine, thanks very much. And finally, I mean, I did say finally just now, but again, finally, I've just noticed something else that you scribbled to me, and that was that we've got search and destroy drones as well. Now, this is something I think which is quite new to London. We've heard about these missile bases on the tops of tower blocks, but not the search and destroy drones.
Yeah, the Predator drones. Yeah, we were told that quite specifically, actually. They said that, they said, you know, if a terrorist attack, you know, happens in a van or anything like that, don't worry, because there's Predator drones in the sky and they will take them out. You won't ever see them, but they're circling London. And again, I found that a little bit worrying as well.
These are the sort of Yemen and Afghanistan type things, aren't they, that have been killing people over there?
That's, we've shown a video, actually. They showed us a PowerPoint presentation, a little bit about the drones, what they do, what they carry, and how now they recognise targets and stuff, how they're flown, remote controlled, and we were shown a little video of them taking out a group of people. I think it was in Afghanistan, and I found that very upsetting, quite honestly. You know, a few people cheered in the crowd, but I don't cheer when I see, you know, people getting killed, whether they're, you know, so-called Taliban terrorists or not. You know, I find that very disturbing, quite frankly.
And do you think it would have been possible for, say, ordinary police to have done this job rather than a massive company like G4S?
Yeah, absolutely. That's what the police are trained for. This is what they do every day. I mean, you know, at least I think if that you were to bring on private security, then, you know, yes, outer perimeters private security with the pedestrian screening areas being, perhaps with the team leader being a policeman. You know, if there's not enough policemen to do the whole job, then private security should be, you know, people who are doing the metal detector and things like that. Professional police to actually oversee that, and professional police people who can train the X-ray operators, who or could be the X-ray operators. You know, surely there's enough people in the country, or, you know, we could even fly them in from around the world, I suppose, who are professional X-ray operators, you know, just for this event. You know, how hard can that be, you know? But I do think the police need to take a bigger role in what they're doing, because as far as they keep saying to us, they keep mentioning the police, but saying, oh, well, the police will be happy to help you, because they'll be bored most of the time. They won't be doing anything.
Well, I mean, I've spoken to journalists who were briefed by the police, freelance journalists in London, and the police are saying, well, we've really got nothing to do with this event. We are not in any way saying who goes in and who goes out at all.
That's right, and they should be. And you know what? When... I was asking. I asked very subtle questions, and you know, so it didn't seem like I'm a journalist sticking my hand up, you know. But when I was asking basically, how are they going to be identifying, you know, potential, you know, terrorists or, you know, undesirables coming in? And he says, don't worry about that. You know, let JTAC handle all that kind of stuff, and that's the Joint Terrorist Analysis Center. But they don't really do anything. All they do is collate information and then pass it on to the relevant agencies. You know, so really, What we're hoping for, really, is for a terrorist to come with a big sign that says, I am a terrorist, and and for the security services to step in. Unfortunately, in my experience and experience of the world, that doesn't tend to happen. So I think the police need to actually, you know, stand up to G4S. This is the police of this country, you know. They are good at what they do. They are hard-working people. You know, we pay them a lot of money to do this. I would like to see them at the Olympics doing their job.
Okay, well, Lee Hazeldine, thanks ever so much for that fascinatingly detailed exclusive report. And we hope to be speaking to you, if you manage to remain undercover, in future weeks.
Okay, Tony, thanks ever so much.
Cheers. Now I'm joined by Martin Summers in the studio. Martin, the implications here are pretty horrific, aren't they? The idea that a private company is running this, and also they are looking at it simply as a money-making exercise. What Lee's alleging there is that they're cutting a lot of corners, and that ultimately that the games are wide open.
Well, I think that's true, but I think also the point he made about the police not being in charge is extremely worrying. We know for a fact from previous history that terrorist attacks on big events like this and big targets like the World Trade Center are not always carried out by people coming from outside. So, for example, I'll give you an example. The underpants bomber, so-called, who was arrested over Detroit supposedly setting off a bomb in his underpants a couple of Christmases ago. We know for a fact, because Laurie Haskell and Kurt Haskell, who are lawyers who are on the plane, have given the information to the international media, it's been ignored here, that he was taken onto the plane without going through security at all by a well-dressed Indian gentleman. And in fact, he didn't have a passport or a ticket. Now, in other words, and that was at Schiphol Airport in Amsterdam. Now, the security at Schiphol Airport is not run by the Dutch authorities. It's been privatised, as we've just been discussing. It's actually run by an Israeli security company called ICTS, who've actually been banned from various Scandinavian airports. Privatisation of security is an open invitation to terrorist attack, and we're not talking about people in caves in Afghanistan. The looks like the underpants bomber was actually a set-up job by somebody's intelligence services. We're not quite sure who.
So what evidence do you have for that?
We've got Kurt Haskell. Go to his blog and you will see he gave evidence at the trial of the guy, which was disallowed, although he did give a statement to the court. He said, I was on that plane, and that he's not the only one. He saw the underpants bomber being taken onto the plane without going through any detectors at all, and that he didn't have a passport or a ticket. Now, in other words, the real problem with terrorist attacks, and we could include 7/7 and 9/11 in this, is that they're not in fact carried out by random people trying to break through a security ring. They're done by people inside the security ring, often connected to intelligence agencies. And this is why you shouldn't privatise security.
Now, this is, you
because
mentioned,
you're opening the door to these kind of things happening.
Well, you mentioned the 7/7 London bombings there.
Indeed.
One thing that very few people know is
Indeed.
That the CCTV surveillance system, which is actually quite sophisticated across the London Underground, was privatised just about 6 months before the London bombings, and privatised to an Israeli firm, Verint Systems. Now, Verint is actually a small company of a parent company, and the boss of that parent company, Kobe Alexander, is on the run from the Securities and Exchange Commission in the United States, having absconded with $13 million of Converse Technologies money, last heard of out in Namibia in hiding, and facing extradition back to the United States. So obviously it's a crooked parent company. But Daniel Bodner, who's the chief executive of Verint Systems, who are the private security firm for the London Underground, and still are, I believe, he's a former Israeli explosives officer in the Corps of Engineers in Israel.
Indeed. So we talk about who are the experts to protect us from the terrorists. So it'll be the experts on anti-terrorism, that'll be the Israelis, and they win these kind of contracts. But it's not just the Israelis. We know that there were exercises running on the day of 7/7, because Peter Power told the TV audience that they were planning exercises on bombs going off in exactly the tube stations where they did go off, which is why when Lee was talking there, I presume that's not his real name, about them talking about there will be some kind of event at the Olympics, and we've provided all these body bags, you don't need to know any more. The worry has to be that the terrorists inside the Western intelligence services, including the Israeli intelligence services, are planning a terrorist attack on the Olympics. And of course, it's far easier to carry out a terrorist attack if you're on the inside. And if we go back to the Munich Olympics and the attack on the Israeli team there, that was carried out by the Abu Nidal faction of the PLO or PFLP. Now, Abu Nidal was widely suspected all over the Middle East of actually working for the Israelis. So in other words, what the Israelis did there, possibly, is attack their own team in order to garner sympathy and so on and so forth.
Fascinatingly enough, we've had a news story this week in The Independent and in various other newspapers. Neo-Nazis helped carry out the Munich Olympics massacre.
Yes, working with the Abu Nidal group. But the Abu Nidal group, he was based in Baghdad eventually, but he's widely believed across the Middle East by serious journalists to have been working, like Robert Fisk in Beirut, for example, to have been an Israeli agent all along. Now, I'm not saying that there is a plan by the Israelis or anybody else to attack the Olympics, but if your task is counter-terrorism at the Olympics, don't just think of people coming from caves in Afghanistan. Think about who are the private companies that are being employed, who are their leaders. I mean, Blackwater and so on, they've been engaged in terrorist activity. Now, the fact is that these private companies are an open invitation to terrorism by well-connected intelligence operatives.
Reports by Iraqi, this is moving up to the present, this is 2 days ago, a news agency called FNA, reports by Iraqi media have revealed that Israeli Secret Service Mossad is very active in Iraq and spying on Iran and its allies under the cover of Jordanian companies. According to a report by Iraqi NAKHEL, that's N-A-K-H-E-L, news agency, Iraqi resistance groups in separate statements have released the information and details of such undercover places and entities in different regions of Iraq, including Taji, Kirkuk and Baghdad, and announced that they have targeted these Israeli sites.
Yes, and also it says in here that they were, that they've been involved. I mean, obviously you expect Mossad to be operating in Iraq as an intelligence agency. Most intelligence agencies are. That's in a way legitimate. But it's suggested that they've been involved in assassinating over 550 scientists and academic figures. So it's in Israel's interest to destroy Iraq's industrial and military capacity, so they've been involved in assassinating scientists. Now, in other words, a lot of the mayhem out there, and we've been talking about Syria in the previous weeks, a lot of the mayhem in Syria is clearly being orchestrated by Western intelligence agencies. The Saudis, the Qataris, the French, the British, the Turks are aiding the rebels. There's no doubt about it. The rebels are terrorists. The Hula massacre, it turns out Frank Werner Annemarie Zeitung has blamed the rebels, not the Assad regime. Now, in other words, terrorists come in all shapes and sizes, and they're not necessarily just Muslim guys with beards.
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
Well, at the beginning of June, we had a good look at the survival in South America of Hitler's deputy, Martin Bormann, as detailed in the book by Paul Manning, who was a European war correspondent for the US network CBS back in the 1940s. That book was Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile. Well, this week, we focus on the efforts of the Israeli Secret Service, the Mossad, to track down and kidnap Nazi war criminals who'd escaped justice at the Nuremberg trials. Among the figures known to have been part of Bormann's network to launder Nazi money and rebuild an economic empire was the notorious Auschwitz concentration camp Dr. Joseph Mengele. The Mossad chief charged with running the kidnap operation was Issa Harel, and his primary targets were Adolf Eichmann, who was Hitler's security chief, who was responsible for the so-called Final Solution, the Nazi program to exterminate the Jewish population. Now, when the Israeli Mossad kidnap squad arrived in South America, they tracked Eichmann and Mengele down to a cafe in Buenos Aires, Argentina, the ABC restaurant, where they were planning a propaganda cover stories to be put out by their wealthy friends to cover their crimes. And at the end of this clip, we hear from the Mossad commander, Issa Harel, himself. And this clip is from a World in Action documentary, which was transmitted in November 1978. And so let's have a listen to that now.
Mengele established himself as owner of a small textile factory in Buenos Aires. We discovered he struck up a remarkable acquaintance with a German-Jewish businessman who discussed the possibility of partnership with Mengele's firm, sited in this street. The Jewish businessman knew Mengele only by his false name of Gregor. He told us that Gregor was getting money from his father, whom he met on a secret visit to Switzerland in 1958. He also remarked that Gregor seemed to be suffering from a guilt complex.
At the same time, Gregor was going by his real name of Mengele at regular rendezvous at this German restaurant on another side of Buenos Aires. There, Mengele, for the first time, met his former overlord and fellow fugitive, Adolf Eichmann, mastermind of Hitler's plan to wipe out the Jews.
SS man Wilhelm Sassens was then working with Eichmann, preparing favourable propaganda to cover up what happened in Nazi concentration camps. But unknown to both Eichmann and Mengele, their capture was being plotted in Europe and Israel. Agents from the Israeli Secret Service, Mossad, were watching this house in Buenos Aires. As an astonished world later learned, the Israelis kidnapped its tenant, Adolf Eichmann, to stand trial in Jerusalem. But first they held him in a secret house in Buenos Aires. But few people know the Israelis nearly pulled off a second coup by capturing Mengele as well, with Eichmann's help. Issa Harel, Mossad chief, led the hunt in the city.
It was only after this operation was assured that we could turn to Mengele. Before departing for Argentina on the Eichmann operation, I looked through the files of all the major war criminals who were believed to have escaped to South America. And in particular, I studied on the dossier of Mengele.
Harel held Eichmann in the Buenos Aires hideout, interrogated him about Mengele, and discovered the curious power Mengele now had over his wartime overlord.
At the moment the name of Mengele was mentioned, Eichmann went into a panic, and he refused to tell us anything about Mengele. It wasn't out of sense of loyalty or something like this. I think it was just of sheer funk, of sheer fright.
Why do you think Eichmann was frightened of Mengele?
I'm not sure, but he might be supported by him, or he might be just afraid of him because he was a strong personality amongst the Nazi refugees in South America.
That was Issa Harrell there, the former head of Mossad, hunting down the Nazi war criminals in South America. Well, he tracked Mengele down to the Paraguayan village of Hohenau, to the home of a man called Alban Krug.
A Nazi gang in the capital was responsible for the shooting. Their leader is a German who came to Paraguay, Enrique Muller, widely known in Asunción as Nazi Muller. While we were filming him with our hidden camera in a restaurant, he said that he sees Mengele every month.
Yes, every week, every month. That's the way people get interrogated. We meet regularly every month to play cards. All he did then was his duty. What the Americans do today, the same bloody experiments which Mengele carried out then. Everybody knows Mengele here. What we were trying to do then was to rid ourselves of society's cripples. You can take that as you like. And when I look at them all today, the way they all run around here, all I can say is that Mengele didn't do anything more than scratch the surface. Hide him? Well, no, I wouldn't need to hide him. The president says he's a Paraguayan citizen. I needn't say any more. Stroessner helps him. There's no need for Stroessner to help him. Listen, everything here is run by different laws. And what is it you don't understand?
When we began to press Muller for details of how Mengele received his money, he grew increasingly suspicious.
He'd got a brother who was a millionaire in Germany. How do I get my money from Germany? In Deutschmark checks, which I change on the black market, and then I've got my money. That's no problem. Do you have to ask such stupid questions? You shouldn't. Leave Mengele alone.
Extracts there from the World in Action documentary about Joseph Mengele, which is available on DVD, actually, still. And that was transmitted on the Monday, the 20th of November, 1978. Now, Martin, what was going on there in the light of what you've been reading in the book, Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile?
By Paul Manning. Well, basically, Eichmann was the last Nazi that was taken by Mossad because the Nazis did a deal with the Israelis after that. Basically, you leave us alone, and we will support the existence of the State of Israel. We will help reparations to be paid to Israel, and so on. It's very interesting. Basically, gangsters are gangsters. Some of them are Jews, and some of them are goy.
Okay, well, Martin, thanks very much. That's all the serious talk out of the way now, because Friday night is music night, kicking off with 2 hours live with Pat Hart and the Fresh Blood Party. Thanks very much to our guest in the first hour, Labour Councillor for St George East, Fabian Breckles, and to old Labour Oxford economist you just heard there, Martin Summers. Next week, well, question mark, a lot can happen in a week. If you're on broadband internet, you can hear our previous Friday drive times, including this programme's 5-point economic recovery plan. Just go to the BCFM website, bcfm.org.uk, or go straight to our page, that is to say via www.thisweek.org.uk. A podcast of this show is online 10 minutes or so after broadcast. I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Now, music this week from 1992.